I'm very concerned about the topic that I'm going to discuss, which is basically the relationship between Christianity and science, because the believing community today, including our children who go to public school or even if they're homeschooled, are constantly berated.
Because with the idea that somehow or other science has undermined Christianity and shown there's no need for God. So we get this image that Christianity is at war with science. And science continues to learn things day by day, week by week, year by year, that somehow show that Christianity is not true and that God is not needed. We can explain everything scientifically. So, for example, not long ago, a very well-known Ivy League biology professor made the following statement. He said, quote, "Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loudly and clearly. There are no gods. There are no purposes in life. There are no goal-directed forces of any kind. There's no life after death. When I die, I'm absolutely certain that I'm going to be dead, and that's the end of me. There's no ultimate foundation for ethics. There's no ultimate meaning to life, and there's no such thing as free will either." Now, when the evening news and the major news media, which turns out to be a rumor mill for science, pop science, when you hear these kinds of pronunciations repeatedly, if you're not careful, it's easy to get hunkered down and to think that somehow science is the enemy of the faith, and it's actually the more they learn, the more it becomes implausible to believe that Christianity is really true. Now, actually, nothing could be further from the truth, but that is basically the assumption that an awful lot of people have today. And the record on this really does need to be corrected, because this is really false. I don't have time today, nor would it be fruitful for me to take this professor's statement apart, but it is a laughably inadequate statement. It is literally laughable. It is so misspoken and so poorly argued. But what I do want to do in our time together is I want to try to discuss in a way that I hope will help you, a little bit more about the relationship between science and Christianity, to show that this picture that is widely circulated is really not true. And I want to proceed in the following way. I want to first of all talk about something called scientism. Then I'm going to talk about areas where scientific discoveries are actually supporting Christianity. And then I'm going to talk about some problem areas that we need to do more work on. And at the end of the day, my conclusion will be that science is actually supporting Christianity more than it's harming it, but there are areas of question that we need to work on. That will be my ultimate conclusion. So I want to begin with a discussion of something called scientism. Years ago, I was invited to do an evangelistic talk in Baltimore, Maryland, and I was warned that a PhD from Johns Hopkins in physics was going to be there, and this gentleman hated Christianity and religion, thought it was a bunch of nonsense, and that he would be at this meeting. So we were at the hors d'oeuvre table before the meeting gathered, and this gentleman came in and came to the hors d'oeuvre table and was introduced to me. And no sooner than we had exchanged pleasantries than this gentleman said, "Well, I understand that you're a philosopher and a theologian," to me. And I said, "Well, you know, I give it my best shot." And he said, "Yeah," he said, "I used to be interested in philosophy when I was a teenager. But," he said, "when I grew up, I outgrew it. Because I came to realize that if you can't prove it and test it in the laboratory, it's nothing but a bunch of nonsense and idle opinion. And you can't test philosophy or religious claims in the lab, so it's just a bunch of hot air." Well, that's how he introduced himself to me. Now, that is scientism. And scientism is basically the idea that science is the only way that we can know reality. that science is the only way that we can know reality. In other words, the only truths that you can really know are the truths that can be proven by the hard sciences. So we could know, for example, whether or not water was H2O or H3O, because science could tell us which answer was correct. We could know what a magnetic field is like and how magnetism relates to electricity, because science can answer that question. We could know how amphibians evolved from fish because science, the science of biology and paleontology, can answer those questions. You can't know whether abortion's right or wrong, because that's not a scientifically amenable question. You can't know what the state ought to do with healthcare, because that's a political question and it's not capable of being answered scientifically. You can't know that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself or whether Allah is God, because those questions cannot be tested or proven and resolved scientifically. It is only scientific questions that we can really know. And everything else is nothing but a bunch of hot air and idle opinion. Now, this is widely believed among people, and I would bet that you have a relative or a friend or someone you know that actually holds this view. Let me say a couple of words about scientism. You understand the view, you feel pretty comfortable with it. It's the claim that something is true and can be known if and only if it can be tested scientifically. Okay, that's basically the idea. Now, the problem, there are many problems with this, and I'll give you a couple of them. The first problem is that scientism is self-refuting. Scientism is self-refuting. Now, let me unpack this. Something is self-refuting if it falsifies itself. Something is self-refuting if it makes itself false. Let me give you an example. There is no sentence longer than three words is self-refuting. That sentence makes itself false. Or again, I cannot utter a word of English would be an example of something that's self-refuting. Or the statement there are no truths would be self-refuting because that statement itself is being offered as a truth. Now, the problem with scientism is that you cannot tell whether scientism is true by the methods of science. And so if someone says that you can only believe what science can prove, then you couldn't believe scientism because the statement, you can only believe what science can prove, cannot itself be proven by a physics experiment or in a chem lab or in a biology text or in neuroscience or anything like that. In fact, the statement that you can only know what science can prove is a philosophical statement in a branch of philosophy known as epistemology. And so the proper people to evaluate this statement would be epistemologists, people that specialize in the theory of knowledge. On our faculty at Talbot School of Theology, we have three professors that are specialists in epistemology. That's their area of academic emphasis. The statement, you can only know what you can prove scientifically, is a philosophical statement that implies that you can't know any philosophical statements. Okay? It is a non-scientific utterance that implies that you can't trust any non-scientific utterances. So I said to the gentleman, I let him go for a couple of minutes. And finally I said, look, I don't know what to do with what you're telling me here, sir, and I'm in a bit of a pickle. Because I said, you've been saying that the only thing that you can know is what can be proven scientifically, and the rest of it's nothing but hot air and idle opinion. Yeah, that's exactly my view. Well, you've been talking for 2 minutes, and so far I can't think of a single sentence that's come out of your mouth that I could test scientifically. No, and then I said, if I'm wrong, tell me which one it was. I'm open to tell me which sentence that you've uttered and how you would test it in a laboratory. But you see, my problem is that if none of your own sentences can be tested scientifically, it turns out that you've been espousing hot air for 2 minutes. Now, you see, this is a serious problem. because people will engage in self-refuting statements all the time. They'll say there are no moral absolutes and you ought to be more tolerant. Well, if there are no moral absolutes, how does it follow that I ought to do anything? Do you understand? So what you have to do is you have to learn to listen for this mistake. So the first problem with scientism is that it's self-refuting. The second problem with scientism is that it fails to recognize that there are assumptions of science that can't be proven by science. It fails to recognize that there are assumptions of science that can't be proven by science. Science makes a lot of assumptions. For example, science assumes that there is a certain thing called truth. Science assumes that mathematics applies to the world, and so on. And I don't have time this day to list the assumptions of science. But science is based on a number of assumptions, and those assumptions cannot themselves be proven scientifically. Again, for example, the notion that there is such a thing as truth and what truth is. When a scientist says that my theories are true, he or she is assuming a certain model of what truth is. But that model of what truth is not a scientific assertion. It is an assertion in other fields. And anybody with an ounce of sense who's been to college would know this, because all you have to do is get a catalog of any university and look at what subjects are taught in what disciplines. And you will not find a seminar in undergraduate or graduate physics or chemistry or biology or neuroscience on the topic, what is truth? Scientists have no clue about that sort of thing. They borrow a view of truth in order to say their views are true. Fair enough. I have no problem with them borrowing. I just don't like it when they borrow and say that you have to shoot the person that you borrowed from. That doesn't make any sense. So, the reason that I believe scientism is false is that, first of all, it's self-refuting, and secondly, it fails to recognize that there are assumptions of science that can't be proven by science. An example of that would be, what sort of a thing is truth, and is there such a thing as truth? That is not something a scientific experiment could tell one way or the other. Now, so that has to do with scientism. That's the first thing I want to mention. The second thing that I'd like to plant firmly in your attention is that 95% of science is irrelevant to Christianity. The overwhelming, and I mean the overwhelming majority of scientific discoveries have nothing whatsoever to do with whether Jesus Christ was the Son of God, whether he rose from the dead, whether there is salvation outside of Christ, whether God exists, whether there's life after death, or what have you. I mean, I could care less whether water's H2O or H15O. It just doesn't make any difference to me as a Christian. And what you have to recognize is that 95% of the discoveries of science are talking about something that has nothing to do with ethics or God or anything of that sort of thing. So this idea that Christianity is at war with science is just nonsense, because in most cases they're talking about totally different things. They have nothing to do with each other. Do you understand that? And so, I mean, you take a look at a doctor who says, well, this antibiotic will work for that, but that one won't. Well, does it follow from that Christ didn't die for everybody? You get the point here. So you want to, I have an undergraduate degree in chemistry. I celebrate science. I actually think that science came from Christian Europe, and that was not an accident. But I do not believe that most of science has anything to do with my practice as a believing Christian. They're different areas of life, that's all. So if anybody tells you that science has undermined Christianity, you need to mention to them that you use a radio and you believe in television sets and you don't think there's anything wrong with medicine or what have you. And you use air conditioning and you're perfectly content to do all these things and love Jesus at the same time, and there's no contradiction in it. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Okay, now, there are I'd say about 5% of the areas that science and Christianity talk about do have implications for one another. 95% irrelevant. Maybe 5% of the things that are talked about in science and in Christian theology do have something to do with each other. And in my opinion, out of that 5%, 4% supports Christianity, and maybe 1 to 1.5% harms Christianity. That's the way I see the record. So let me now talk about areas of scientific discovery that have actually tended to support the Christian faith. Number one, the discovery that the universe began to exist. The only people in the ancient Near Eastern world that believed the universe began to exist were the biblical Hebrews. The Babylonians, the Egyptians, no one believed that the universe began to exist. They believed the cosmos had always been here, except for one people, Bible-believing Hebrews, that believed on the basis of revelation, that this universe had not been here forever. Now, what is interesting is that discoveries have been made to support the fact that the Bible was right about this, and the other people were wrong. The first discovery that was made along these lines took place somewhere around the a few centuries before Christ and a few centuries after Christ, where a philosophical argument was discovered that proved the universe had a beginning. And this philosophical argument turns on the impossibility of anything crossing infinity. It's impossible to cross infinity. Even God can't do it. Nothing, including the Supreme Being, can cross an infinite number of events or move through infinity. Now, to illustrate this, remember, infinity is infinitely larger than anything finite. This is very important to keep. Infinity is not finite. It's not just a big finite number. Infinity is infinity. It's infinitely larger than any finite number. Now, suppose I went to heaven and God said to me, you did a decent job down there, but so you're here and you love Jesus and the rest of it. But I have got some bad news. I wasn't pleased with the number of those lectures you gave. And so you're going to have to count the natural numbers forever. So get started. So I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I count, and I get up to 50 quadrillion zillion. Another guy dies, and he's given the same assignment, and he just gets started, and he's up to the number 75. And I'm at 50 quadrillion zillion, and I look over at this poor sucker, and I think, man, this guy is way behind me. Until it dawns on me that we both have the same number of numbers left to count. That is an infinite number, because it's inexhaustible. No matter how far I go, I've made no progress because I still have an infinite. If I only had a finite number of numbers left to count, then the number would be how many I counted at that point, 50 quadrillion zillion plus the finite, but that would be finite. If I'm counting to infinity, I will still have an infinite number of numbers left to count. So you can't go from one to infinity. Well, it follows that you couldn't go from minus infinity to zero. If you can't go from zero to infinity, you couldn't go from minus infinity to zero because it's the same distance, if that makes sense to you. No. Well, stay with me. And if it doesn't make sense, you're not supposed to say it out loud, for heaven's sakes. No, it doesn't. Okay. All right. So suppose that this is the present moment, and we freeze this moment, and here's yesterday, and here's 50 years ago, and here's 50,000 years ago, and here's 50 billion years ago, and here's 50 trillion years ago. If the world never had a beginning, how far does this go? Forever. Is there an edge back here? If there were an edge, what would that be? That would be the beginning of the finite time. If there's no beginning, there's no edge. That means that in order for the universe to reach zero, which is the present moment while I'm speaking, the universe would have to have gone through an infinite number of earlier moments. But that's impossible. It follows that if the universe never had a beginning, the present moment could have never showed up. Because to reach the present moment would require the universe to cross through an infinite number of earlier moments. So that there had to be a first event. There had to be a beginning to time. The reason that God can't cross infinity is because he doesn't have to. He's outside time. So God isn't living in time. He's a timeless being without the universe. Now, what this means is that this was a philosophical argument that was hinted at by Aristotle and was actually developed by a guy named John Polyponius in the third century. And this argument, I believe, demonstrates that the past is finite and there was a creation event, a beginning. Now, in the 1800s, scientists discovered something called the second law of thermodynamics. And this is the idea that the universe is running out of gas. It's using up its useful energy. It's called entropy, but that's not relevant. It's basically the idea that the universe is using up the energy that's available to do work. It's using up its useful energy. Now, you might want to think of the universe then as a tank of gasoline. As time goes on, that tank of gasoline runs out of gas. And in fact, Time magazine a few years ago had an article on how the universe would eventually end. And it said a time will come when there will first of all be no light anywhere. Secondly, there's not going to be any pockets of heat. Because the nuclear and chemical reactions that are generating the light and the heat are going to run out of fuel, and everything's going to turn cold and dark. And finally, everything will be motionless. The universe is going to die a quiescent death, where everything, there will be no heat, light, it will be largely uniform, and there will be no motion. Now, do you understand the implications of this? And some of you had chemistry and will remember the name Lord Kelvin. Because sometimes temperature is measured in degrees Kelvin. Kelvin was a believer who saw that once the second law was discovered, it implied a creation of the universe. Because if the universe is running out of energy and it hasn't run out of it yet, it follows that the universe hasn't been using up its energy forever. Because if the universe had been using up its fuel forever, it would have already run out of fuel an infinite number of years ago. The fact that we haven't turned the lights off yet means that we haven't been using the gas tank forever. And that means that there had to be a beginning when the universe was wound up. As Ted Koppel said once on Nightline, bangs would seem to have bangers. Now, the point is that we have now discovered that the universe began to exist. Now, science will never explain the origin of the universe. And here's why. Scientific explanations presuppose the universe before they can begin. If you're going to give a scientific explanation for something, you have to already assume the universe exists. To say it differently, and I know this is heavy stuff, so just, you know, I'll be out of here in an hour, so you can, if you're mad at me. But science, a precondition that has to be present before science can start explaining anything, is that you've already got a universe with time. Think of scientific explanation. Science explains why water freezes at a certain temperature. Science explains why a certain kind of lightning will strike in a certain area or certain clouds form given certain weather conditions. Or why oxygen requires two hydrogen atoms instead of more than that. Or why this particular organ in a frog isn't functioning any longer. Now notice that all those explanations already presuppose that there are frogs, that there's oxygen and hydrogen, and you get the point. There cannot be an explanation of the origin of the very thing you have to assume before you can start explaining anything. Science cannot explain the origin of the universe because science has got to already presuppose a universe before it has anything to work on. Now, this is why when Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins was again on the O'Reilly Show. You might think I have this fetish with O'Reilly. I do tend to watch him quite often, but Richard Dawkins was on the O'Reilly Show, and O'Reilly said to Dawkins, "Well, you know, where did the universe come from?" And Dawkins said, "We're working on it." What, in other words, Dawkins thought that give us a little bit more time and more research and we will come up with an answer to the question. What Dawkins didn't realize is the science's inability to explain the origin of the universe has nothing to do with the current status of our knowledge. It has to do with the inadequacies of science itself. This is not an objection that is based upon the current status of scientific research. This is an objection in principle about the limitations of science itself. Science will never explain the origin of the very thing it needs before it can begin explaining anything. Now, Stephen Hawking says that the laws of gravity caused the universe to come into existence out of nothing. But you read more carefully and you realize, number one, the laws of gravity can't explain anything until you've already got a universe. The laws of gravity can't start explaining something until you have a universe. So the laws of gravity can't explain the origin of the universe. Furthermore, when he says that the laws of gravity explain the origin of the universe from nothing, he's not talking about nothing. He's talking about what's called a quantum vacuum, where he thinks that you can explain the origin of the universe from something called a quantum vacuum. Well, I think God would say to him, get your own quantum vacuum. You know, if you're going to explain where everything came from, get your own vacuum. Don't borrow mine. So the point is that there is no scientific explanation for the origin of the universe. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, whatever explains the origin of the universe has to be timeless, spaceless, immaterial, because what we have coming into existence is the material universe. It has to be supernatural, which means it's capable of acting outside the laws of nature because they didn't exist yet. And it has to have the power of free will. It has to be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, supernatural, meaning it can act above the laws of nature. And it has to have the power of free choice in order to simply say, come into existence now. And that's pretty close to God. You're getting real close. This kind of an entity ought to make an atheist very uncomfortable. Okay, so that's the first thing that I want to mention. Has been a discovery science has made. Remember, the discovery began with a philosophical discovery. Then it moved to the discovery of the second law. And I didn't mention, but then it moved to the discovery of the Big Bang, which I believe was the original creation event that God acted in creating the very beginning of the universe, which is then subsequently described in Genesis and so on, but not the very first instant. Okay. Now, the second thing that has been positively supported by science toward Christianity is called the discovery of fine-tuning. The discovery of fine-tuning. This is so powerful. What I'm about to tell you is so powerful that the leading intellectual atheist in the world from around 1955 or so up until a couple of years ago, the leading atheist for 50 years in Western culture was British philosopher Anthony Flew. But about 4 years ago, he converted at the end of his life toward belief in God, and not because he was afraid of dying or had a need for God. He said, I have no interest in God, but I now know there has to be a God. and he converted to belief in God because of the evidence I'm about to give you, and some other evidence I'll give you a little bit later. But one of the things that persuaded Flew that there had to be a supreme being was the scientific discovery of fine-tuning. Now, let me try to explain what fine-tuning is. Scientists have discovered a number of features of the universe. For example, we now know how much charge an electron has. We've been able to measure to several decimal points the negative charge on an electron. We also know, for example, the rest mass of a proton, how much mass a proton has when it's at rest. And we've been able to measure that out to several decimal points. There is also something called the universal force of gravity in the universe, and we've been able to measure how strong, it's called the gravitational constant, but for our purposes, just think of gravity. We've been able to measure how strong gravity is in the universe out to several decimal points. Another example would be the rate of expansion of the universe. The universe is expanding as time goes on, and we've been able to measure the accelerated rate of expansion of the universe. Do you understand the sort of thing I'm talking about here now? So scientists have been able to discover 30, 40, or 50 such constants of nature. And if you take a look at a chemistry or a physics book, they're listed, and they help you solve problems by looking at the gravitational constant and so on. Here's what they didn't know. And here's what they discovered that was brand new information. If you change any one of these by an order of a billionth of a percentage point, either way, larger or smaller, you can't get any life of any kind anywhere in the universe. If the charge on an electron were a billionth of a percentage point, more strongly or less strongly charged, if it were just a fraction more strongly negatively charged or just a little bit less negatively charged, you're not going to get the kind of chemical reactions that will allow life to appear anywhere in the universe. If the force of gravity were infinitesimally smaller or larger, no living systems anywhere. And the same, not only for one or two, but for all 30, 40, or 50, I've seen different estimates on the numbers of these. Now, this led a British physicist, Paul Davies, to say, it looks like the dice were rigged ahead of time so life could appear in the cosmos. And you see, the problem is that since these numbers are exactly tuned so life would appear, this could hardly be a coincidence. Now, contrast that with what they used to believe. They used to believe that these values played little or no role in anything. So that if an electron had turned out to have been twice as much charged, negatively charged as it is, it wouldn't have much of an impact on anything. Or if gravity were stronger or weaker, it wouldn't be no big deal. We just have a different universe with life in it, but everything would go on pretty much as it is with a little bit of difference. But what they've discovered is that's not true. There is an extremely narrow window through which, and only through which, life can appear. Given the laws of nature, that life can appear in that kind of a universe. And the fact that those constants all showed up so life could appear provides evidence that these constants were selected on purpose so that living things could arise in the universe. The universe appears to have wanted us to show up, in other words. And I'm speaking, you know, obviously it was God who wanted us to show up, but I'm speaking here figuratively. And this is powerful, powerful evidence because this could hardly have been done by coincidence. A third discovery that we made that I believe provides evidence that God exists is the discovery of biological information. Now, to unpack this, let's back off and think about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the search for life in outer space. This is a scientific project that began at Cornell University called SETI. Maybe you've heard of that, S-E-T-I. And there are scanners all across the globe that are scanning the heavens for signals of life from outer space. I don't think they're going to find any, but that's not relevant to my purposes for right now. What's relevant is that there have been millions upon millions of dollars that have been invested in the SETI research project to try to see if we could discover any indication of life in outer space. Now, I think that you would agree that if you're going to look for life in outer space, you ought to have some way of telling when you found it, right? And scientists do. They have developed a way of telling how you can recognize life in outer space without just staring at it. And here's how they would recognize it. They have drawn a distinction between randomness, order, and information. Randomness, order, and information. Let me illustrate these. Suppose I had alphabet soup, and I just tossed it up in the air, and a fan came on, and it scattered this alphabet soup, and some letters landed on the podium here. So here I have an A, an upside-down Q, a sideways Z. Here's the square root of minus 1. And that would be random. And if you were going to tell a computer to generate a random sequence, here's what you'd tell the computer. Select any letter and repeat. Select any letter and repeat. And what you'd get would be random. Notice, first of all, that that's not specific. It doesn't say pick a specific letter and repeat. It says pick any old letter and repeat. So it's not specific. And secondly, it's very simple. It only has two instructions. Pick any letter and repeat. Okay, you with me on that? Now let's contrast that with alphabet soup with the 500 M-E's in a row. M-E, 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 500 times. That's not random. That's what scientists would call ordered. Now, if I were going to generate an ordered sequence, like M-E's, a sequence of a series of M-E's, I would give the computer three instructions. Pick an M, pick an E, and repeat. Notice, first of all, that's specific. It's not non-specific, it's specific, right? But it's still pretty simple. Only three instructions. You with me on that at this point? Now, you remember the movie Jodie Foster? It was in called Contact, where she was a SETI scientist, where they discovered life in outer space in the movie. And the movie was scientifically accurate in the sense of what they were trying to do. Now, if Jodie Foster discovered a signal from outer space that was either random or simple order, she would not conclude there was intelligent life in outer space. And the reason is that you can explain simple order or randomness by the processes of nature. Nature, pulsating stars will generate a signal that's ordered. It'll just pulsate. And you can get random noise from outer space. So if you listen to the headsets and you're getting random noise, you won't stop drinking your coffee and go to the New York Times. If you get a very simple little ordered signal, same thing. The third category is big time different. Information. An example of that would be John Loves Mary, or the Gettysburg Address, or the Book of Romans, for example. Now, if you think about John Loves Mary, you notice that what you've got here is something that is not only specific, because you have to have a J followed by an O, followed by an H, and so on. But this is highly complex. It's not simple. And in order to generate John Loves Mary, you would have to tell a computer 14 separate instructions. Print a J and O and H and N a space, L-O-V-E-S space M-A-R-Y. If you were going to do the Gettysburg Address, you're getting up there. The Book of Romans, you're really getting up there. Now, what scientists assume in the SETI project, and I believe that this is a correct assumption, they assume that information can only come from an intelligent agent or mind. So that if they discover a signal from outer space that has information in it, they will include it came from an intellectual intelligent agent of some kind. In the movie Contact, I believe that it was the discovery of a signal containing the first 20 prime numbers in a row, which if you a prime number can be divided by one in itself only. And you just think about that, that's not random and it's not simple order. It is a highly information-rich signal. And if we discovered the first 20 prime numbers in a row in real life, I would conclude there's life in outer space. Because I agree that you can only get information from an intelligent mind. But now we have a problem, and it isn't coming from Houston. We have a problem because the most important discovery of 20th century biology is that living things are made out of information. A DNA molecule contains libraries of information in it. There's more information in a DNA molecule than in the library at USC where I took my doctorate. It's filled to overflowing with information. Now, here's the problem. If information can only come from an intelligent mind, it follows that if there's information in a DNA molecule, the best explanation will be that it came from an intelligent mind. And that's using a principle that that scientists themselves use. This isn't a jury-rigged principle. So what I'm suggesting to you is, by the way, when Darwin was doing his work and they looked at the cell under a microscope, the microscopes weren't very good in those days, and a cell looked like just a bunch of jelly. So the idea that you could have some prebiotic soup that could give rise to jelly wasn't that tough to choke down in those days. Today, however, we have discovered that the cell is not composed of jelly, it is like a city. It has a police department, it has an information bureau, it is engineered shockingly well, and it is filled with information. So please look, let me show you here. The jump from non-living things to living things in Darwin's day was about like that. But the more we've learned, the jump from non-living things to living things is like that. And the idea that you're going to bridge that gap by natural processes without an intelligent creator, designer, being standing behind those processes is becoming less reasonable to believe as time goes on, not more reasonable to believe. And one of the keys has been the discovery that living things contain information and that information comes from a divine, from a mind. So people will say to you, why do you believe in God? And I'll say, number one, the universe began to exist. We now know that. Philosophical argument, the second law and the Big Bang. And you can't get a universe popping into existence from nothing. Stephen Hawking just says the universe popped into existence out of a quantum vacuum, but that's not nothing, and he can't tell me where the vacuum came from. The second reason I believe in God is that we've now discovered that the universe is very, very delicately fine-tuned, so that if any of these numbers were slightly different one way or the other, you can't get living systems. It appears that life is only possible within a very, very narrow limit of these values, and they all turned out to be just right so we could show up. Third reason I believe in God, and there are many, many, including my own testimony, but I'm just going down through scientific arguments here, is the discovery that information comes from intelligent minds and living systems are filled with libraries of information. The next reason that the next discovery that points to the existence of God is the origin of consciousness. It's the origin of consciousness. Now, we doing okay? We feeling some love? Okay. All right. Okay. You know that water can be in three states, solid, liquid, and gas, and those are all states of water. That make sense? Consciousness can exist in five states. There are five states of consciousness. The first are called sensations. A sensation is a state of consciousness. An example of a sensation would be seeing yellow or smelling a rose. If you're smelling a rose, you're having a sensation of a certain smell. A feeling of pain would be a sensation, or pleasure. Those emotions are sensations, a feeling of anger or anxiety. Those are sensations. The next state of consciousness are thoughts. A thought is not a sensation. A thought is a mental content that can be true or false. So you can have the thought that snow is white, and you can express that in English as snow is white, or in German as Schnee ist weiß. It's different sentences, but the same thought. The sentence is on the sheet of paper. Where's the thought? It's in your mind. It's in your mind. Okay? It's in your it's a state of your conscious life. It's a conscious state. Third state of consciousness is what are called beliefs. Your belief that 2 and 2 is 4, or your belief that such and such, whatever it might be, you have beliefs. Beliefs are not the same thing as thoughts. You can have thoughts you don't believe, and you can have beliefs you're not thinking about. So thoughts and beliefs are different. Fourth, there are what are called desires. A desire is a felt inclination towards or away from something. You have a felt inclination towards something or away from something. Say toward ice cream or being a good dad or away from something. You want to avoid the dentist, let's say, or whatever it might be. Now, so what we have are desires. And then finally, what we have are acts of will or free choice, a volitional act, an act of will, where you freely choose to raise your hand and you raise it freely and voluntarily, maybe to vote. So you want to vote, you raise your hand in order to vote. That's an act of freedom. That's a free choice. Now, these are all states of consciousness. And what it turns out that none of these is physical. They're all mental. They're not physical. You can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear a thought. By the way, these are also not in your brain. Your brain can't think if its life depended on it. Your brain doesn't have thoughts in it. Your brain doesn't have sensations in it. Your brain is an electrolyzed piece of meat. What thinks is your soul or yourself or your I or your mind. Now, it may use the brain. For example, it is you that sees through your eyes. Your eyes don't see anything. You do through your eyes. You understand that? Your brain doesn't think. You do by using your brain. But your brain is completely incapable of doing anything but just receiving electrical current and undergoing chemical changes. Your memories aren't in your brain. I don't even know what that means. I mean, I'm supposed to peel your brain open and see your memories in there? What is that supposed to mean? It's crazy. A way to think about this, suppose that you have a CD and you know that the CD is magnetized tape. Sounds aren't in the CD. There are no sounds in the CD. What you have are grooved configurations of magnetic tape. Okay? If you put that in the right circumstance, it will produce a sound. Similarly, your memories aren't in your brain. What you have are neural grooves or pathways that occur in your brain, like the grooves of a CD, which under the right circumstances will cause a memory to occur in your mind. But your mind and your consciousness are not physical. They're immaterial. You can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear a thought. You can't split my brain open and see my beliefs or my desires or my sensations or anything like that. Let me give you an illustration of this. What's going on when a person's sleeping and their eyes are moving? They're dreaming. How do we know that? Brain waves. Why do you think the brain has anything to do with it? You have to wake them up and ask them. Absolutely right. You have to wake them up and ask them what's going on while you're measuring the brain waves and seeing the eyes move. Why do you have to ask them? Because you don't have access to the dreaming. All you have is access to the brain waves. You can correlate brain waves with dreaming, but you can't say they're the same thing. Because it's only the patient who has access to his dreams. They're private. All the scientist has access to is the brain. And they are not the same thing. They're different. So that the mind is different from the brain. Now, here's how I liken this. I liken this to the relationship between the mind and the brain to a person driving in a car. Suppose that I were in the front seat of a car and I were seat belted into the seat and the seat belt was locked tightly around me and the doors were locked so I literally could not get out of that driver's seat. And I'm driving around town in the car and something happens to the steering wheel so that it will only turn right and it won't turn left. Would that affect my ability to move around? Yeah. Would that prove I was the car? No, that just proves that while I'm in the car, I depend on it working in order for me to work. Now, the same thing is if you're in your body, you depend upon your body and your brain working for you to work. If something happens to your steering wheel, you'll lose your memories. If something happens to your brain chemistry, you will not be able to withstand depression and anxiety. But that doesn't prove that you're your brain any more than fiddling with a steering wheel proves that you're the car. All that proves is that the two work together and they have to both work. You can change your brain chemistry by changing your thoughts. Did you know that? There's been a ton of research that has demonstrated this. Now, and by the way, if you can get out of the car, then the fact that the car's broken down is not going to hinder your ability to move around town if you get out of the car. I don't know if you saw that little YouTube video that's been circulating about that little boy in Nebraska who died and went to heaven and saw Jesus. And you might think, well, he could have just said that because he was raised in a Christian home. That could have been oxygen deprivation of the brain. Fair enough. But then he met his grandfather. And he'd never seen his grandfather in his life. He'd seen a picture of him, but the picture of his grandfather that he saw in heaven, the image, was of a much younger man without glasses, and the only thing he'd ever seen was an old picture of his grandfather with glasses, and he described accurately what his granddad looked as a younger man. Third thing that happened was that he met a sister that he didn't know he had, and he said to his mom and dad, "I have another sister, don't I?" And they'd never told him that. They'd had a miscarriage. Now, what do you make of that? These things, there are too many of these not to doubt them. There are too many of them. I have a friend whose grandfather died in the operating table and he was watching an older and younger doctor try to bring him back from up above on the hospital ceiling. He was able to see without a brain or eyeballs. He could think without a brain. He didn't have any sense organs, folks. But he could see the entire room and observe what was going on. So it follows that when you're in the car, if the car is broken down, that doesn't prove you're the car or your body or brain. It just proves that when you're in your body, if your body doesn't work, you won't work. But all bets are off once you get out of the car. Okay? Now, yeah. Yeah. Now, here's the deal. You can't get mind from matter, because that's getting something from nothing. If you start without God and you say in the beginning were the particles, and all you do is rearrange these particles according to the laws of chemistry and physics over time, you know what you're going to end up with? Rearranged particles. You're not going to end up with consciousness. Because if consciousness squirts into existence at some point in the evolutionary tree, that would be getting something, consciousness, from nothing, pure matter. And you can't get something from nothing. The only way that there could be finite consciousness in you and me is if you say in the beginning was the Logos, not in the beginning were the particles. Because if the universe begins with mind, we can explain the origin of subsequent minds. But if the universe begins with matter, we can't explain the origin of subsequent, the appearance of consciousness. So we have the science has lent support, in my view, to Christian claims by supporting the existence of the beginning of the universe, by supporting the fine-tuning of the universe, by supporting the idea that living things contain information, by showing, in my view, that consciousness is not the same thing as the brain, and that raises the question of where could consciousness come from? Where does the mind come from in a purely material world? Answer, nowhere. So we don't live in a purely material world. And then finally, I want to talk about one other thing called irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity. This is an argument that's been advanced by Michael Behe, and you may have heard of this argument, but let me, I'll close this section with this, then I'll make a final set of remarks and we'll be through for the day. So if, hang in there with me for another 10 or 15 minutes and then we'll be closed. But what is irreducible complexity? Let me give you a $1.98 definition and then unpack it for you. Here's irreducible complexity. It is a whole made of parts. It is a whole, W-H-O-L-E, made of parts, where no part works without all the other parts. It is a whole made of parts where no part works without the other parts. In other words, the parts are interdependent for their functioning. The parts are interdependent for their functioning. And Behe uses the example of a mousetrap. He says you got five parts in a mousetrap. You've got the wooden base, you've got the trap itself, you have the spring, you have the thing that you put the bait on, and the latch. Now, the mousetrap won't work with four of those parts. All five need to be there, you don't have a mousetrap. Each part needs all the other parts to be there, or the mousetrap doesn't work. You with me on that at this point? That's why you could never evolve a mousetrap part at a time. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't do anything. If you were to start with a piece of wood and then stick a spring on it, that's not going to help it survive, because the spring won't do anything. Now, Behe argues, for example, that there's this little microscopic organism that called a flagellum that has a little motor on it that's composed of something like 100 different parts. This thing looks almost exactly like the gear shift on a motorboat. This thing will turn at 100,000 RPM, stop on a dime, and turn that fast in the other direction and move these little guys through fluid. What they've discovered is that this rotary tail that has this rotary on it, that has all these parts, won't work if any one of the parts isn't present. You got to have all the, let's say 50 parts. You have to have all 50 parts in just the right place or the whole thing doesn't work. You can't evolve a rotary tail, therefore, a slight change at a time. because nothing's going to do anything until you've got the final step. So from part one to 49, if you evolve part one and then evolve part two somehow, the organism is probably going to be hindered by carrying around these extra parts that don't function. Do you understand the problem? The problem, see, evolution says that we will evolve things as long as they help the organism survive. But what good is a motor that only has 48 of the 50 parts needed to work, and it won't work? So what we've discovered, and what Behe has argued, is that scientists have discovered that living things contain irreducibly complex structures. That is, structures like this rotary tail on the flagellum that won't work until all the parts are in place, and those structures can't be evolved, according to Darwinian theory, small little part at a time. Because from the time it starts evolving until the time you have all the parts in place, it's not going to convert any survival value on its possessor because it doesn't work. And evolution can't explain the origin of these, and they look strangely designed. That's what Behe argues. They have evidence of they look like designed structures. Now, I could go on, but what I'm trying to say to you is, and do not believe the lie that science is undermining Christianity or belief in God. 95% of science has got nothing to do with what we believe, and it's irrelevant. However, there are areas where science is contributing to undergirding theological claims. So it's not like it's all negative. A lot of it's positive. Now, are there some negative things? Yes, there are. Example. I'll give you three or four cases. One example is that there does seem to be some evidence for the theory of evolution. And we would be intellectually dishonest if we didn't admit there's evidence for the theory. And that provides a problem. And so what we've got to do is to find a way to reconcile this difficulty. And people are working on it. And this idea of irreducible complexity is one solution to the problem. But we have more work to do. So the general theory of evolution does present problems for the early chapters of Genesis. I will agree with that, and there are difficulties here. Secondly, the problem with the age of the universe and the Earth. There are two kinds of conservative Bible-believing creationists. There are young Earth creationists and old Earth creationists. Neither is an evolutionist. They don't buy the theory of evolution. They both believe in the inerrant scriptures. They're both biblically faithful. Young Earth creationists believe that the Earth was created in six literal 24-hour periods that are consecutive, and that this happened recently, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. Old Earth creationists, of which I include myself, believe that the universe is 13.5 billion years old, that the Earth is 4 billion years old, and that life was first created on the Earth maybe 3.87 billion years ago, but that human being, Adam and Eve, are fairly recent. I also believe that God created all the different kinds of life miraculously, but they weren't spaced over a literal six 24-hour period of time. Now, if you are a young Earth creationist and you believe in a six literal 24-hour day period, then you need to understand that the scientific evidence at this point is against you. That doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means that you got work to do. Does that make sense to you? You don't do yourself any good by saying, well, all the evidence is in my favor, because at this point it's not. That doesn't mean you won't turn out to be vindicated. It just means at this state of the game, the evidence tends to count against you in the scientific community. I'm not suggesting there isn't any evidence in your favor. There is, but I think it's pretty honest to say at this point, that's a problem. That's going to be a problem for you. And I and a number of others that are faithful to Scripture have adopted an old Earth view of the universe while still being strict creationists about the different kinds of life. Third area would be Noah's flood. There doesn't appear to be much evidence that there was a universal flood of Noah. There's a little bit of evidence, but there's not good evidence for it at this point. So that's a problem, and there needs to be more work done on that. And another example would be certain archaeological discoveries that run contrary to what the Bible seems to teach. Now, archaeology has been very favorable to the Bible, but there are problems. There are problems. Now, so these are areas of difficulty. I want to call your attention to the problems, and then I'll summarize and we'll be through for the day. But here's what I want to call your attention to. None of these problems has anything to do with whether God exists and whether Christianity is true at its core. Instead, they all attack biblical inerrancy. They are all problems with those of us who believe, as I do, that the Bible is the inerrant word of God and doesn't teach any falsehoods. That is my view. So these become problems for biblical inerrantists like me, but they're not problems with whether or not there's a supreme being and whether or not he's the Christian God, because that's not a matter of whether Noah's flood was universal or local or whether there's evidence for it. That's a matter of whether Jesus rose from the dead. So what I'm suggesting to you is, in closing then, that while 95% of science is irrelevant, a lot of what science is discovering as we make more discoveries is actually supporting the existence of the biblical God and the truth of Christianity. There are problems, but those problems tend to target not the existence of a supreme being or the reliability of Jesus' life and resurrection, but rather specific things like the Tower of Babel and other problems that are difficulties for those of us who believe in a completely reliable, trustworthy scripture. And the solution to that is that we need Christian scholars to continue to work on these problems. It doesn't mean we're wrong, it just means we have work to do. But I don't know of any theory or worldview that doesn't have things they gotta solve. And that's kind of where I leave it. And so I hope that uplifts you and is encouraging to you, and you'll be able to use some of this in your life and in your witness. Thank you very much. Thank you.